Chapter 84. Mark Twain on his trip around the world. It was a trick photograph made from a picture of Mark Twain taken in a steamer chair, cut out and combined with a dilapidated Negro cart drawn by a horse and an ox. In it, Clemens appears to be sitting luxuriously in the end of the disreputable cart. His companions are two Negroes. To the creator of this ingenious effect, Mark Twain sent a characteristic acknowledgement. To T.S. Frisby, Vienna, October 25, '97. Mr. T.S. Frisby, dear sir. The picture has reached me, and has moved me deeply. That was a steady, sympathetic and honorable team, and although it was not swift, and not showy, it pulled me around the globe successfully, and always attracted its proper share of attention, even in the midst of the most costly and fashionable turnouts. Princes and dukes and other experts were always enthused by the harness, and could hardly keep from trying to buy it. The barouche does not look as fine now as it did earlier, but that was before the earthquake. The portraits of myself and uncle and nephew are very good indeed, and your impressionist reproduction of the palace of the Governor General of India is accurate and full of tender feeling. I consider that this picture is much more than a work of art. How much more, one cannot say with exactness, but I should think 2/3 more. Very truly yours, Mark Twain. Following the Equator was issued by subscription through Mark Twain's old publishers, the Blisses, of Hartford. The sale of it was large, not only on account of the value of the book itself, but also because of the sympathy of the American people with Mark Twain's brave struggle to pay his debts. When the newspapers began to print exaggerated stories of the vast profits that were piling up, Bliss became worried, for he thought it would modify the sympathy. He cabled Clemens for a denial, with the following result. To Frank E. Bliss, in Hartford. Vienna, November 4, 1897. Dear Bliss, your cablegram informing me that a report is in circulation which purports to come from me, and which says I have recently made $82,000 and paid all my debts has just reached me, and I have cabled back my regret to you that it is not true. I wrote a private letter a short time ago, in which I expressed the belief that I should be out of debt within the next 12 months. If you make as much as usual for me out of the book, that belief will crystallize into a fact, and I shall be wholly out of debt. I am encoring you now. It is out of that moderate letter that the $82,000 mare's nest has developed. But why do you worry about the various reports? They do not worry me. They are not unfriendly, and I don't see how they can do any harm. Be patient, you have but a little while to wait. The possible reports are nearly all in. It has been reported that I was seriously ill. It was another man. Dying, it was another man. Dead, the other man again. It has been reported that I have received a legacy. It was another man. That I am out of debt. It was another man. And now comes this $82,000, still another man. It has been reported that I am writing books for publication. I am not doing anything of the kind. It would surprise and gratify me if I should be able to get another book ready for the press within the next 3 years. You can see, yourself, that there isn't anything more to be reported. Invention is exhausted. Therefore, don't worry, Bliss, the long night is breaking. As far as I can see, nothing remains to be reported, except that I have become a foreigner. When you hear it, don't you believe it. And don't take the trouble to deny it. Merely just raise the American flag on our house in Hartford, and let it talk. Truly yours, Mark Twain. P.S. This is not a private letter. I am getting tired of private letters. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Vienna Hotel Metropole, Nov. 1997. Dear Joe, above is our private and permanent address for the winter. You needn't send letters by London. I am very much obliged for Forrest's Austro-Hungarian articles. I have just finished reading the first one. and in it, I find that his opinion and Vienna's are the same, upon a point which was puzzling me, the paucity, no, the absence, of Austrian celebrities. He and Vienna both say the country cannot afford to allow great names to grow up, that the whole safety and prosperity of the empire depends upon keeping things quiet, can't afford to have geniuses springing up and developing ideas and stirring the public soul. I am assured that every time a man finds himself blooming into fame, they just softly snake him down and relegate him to a wholesome obscurity. It is curious and interesting. 3 days ago the New York World sent and asked a friend of mine, correspondent of a London daily, to get some Christmas greetings from the celebrities of the empire. She spoke of this. Two or three bright Austrians were present. They said, here are none who are known all over the world. None who have achieved fame. None who can point to their work and say it is known far and wide in the earth. There are no names. Kossuth, known because he had a father and lecher who made the 12-hour speech. Two names, nothing more. Every other country in the world, perhaps, has a giant or two whose heads are way up and can be seen, but ours. We've got the material, have always had it, but we have to suppress it. We can't afford to let it develop. Our political salvation depends upon tranquility, always has. Poor Livy. She is laid up with rheumatism, but she is getting along now. We have a good doctor, and he says she will be out of bed in a couple of days, but must stay in the house a week or 10. Clara is working faithfully at her music, John at her usual studies, and we all send love. Mark. Mention has already been made of the political excitement in Vienna. The trouble between the Hungarian and German legislative bodies presently became violent. Clemens found himself intensely interested, and was present in one of the galleries, when it was cleared by the police. All sorts of stories were circulated, as to what happened to him, one of which was cabled to America. A letter to Twitchell sets forth what really happened. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Hotel Metropole, Vienna, December 10, 97. Dear Joe, Pond sends me a Cleveland paper with a cablegram from here in it which says that, when the police invaded the parliament and expelled the 11 members, I waved my handkerchief and shouted Hotch die Duchen! ... and got hustled out. Oh dear, what a pity it is that one's adventures never happen. When the ordner, sergeant-at-arms, came up to our gallery and was hurrying the people out, a friend tried to get leave for me to stay by saying, but this gentleman is a foreigner, you don't need to turn him out, he won't do any harm. Oh, I know him very well, I recognize him by his pictures, and I should be very glad to let him stay, but I haven't any choice because of the strictness of the orders. And so we all went out and no one was hustled. Below, I ran across the London Times correspondent, and he showed me the way into the first gallery, and I lost none of the show. The first gallery had not misbehaved, and was not disturbed. We cannot persuade Livy to go out in society yet, but all the lovely people come to see her, and Clara and I go to dinner parties, and around here and there, and we all have a most hospitable good time. John's wood carving flourishes, and her other studies. Goodbye, Joe, and we all love all of you. Mark. Clemens made an article of the Austrian troubles, one of the best things he ever wrote, and certainly one of the clearest elucidations of the Austro-Hungarian confusions. It was published in Harper's Magazine, and is now included in his complete works. Thus far none of the Webster Company debts had been paid, at least, none of importance. The money had been accumulating in Mr. Rogers' hands, but Clemens was beginning to be depressed by the heavy burden. He wrote asking for relief. Part of a letter to H.H. Rogers, in New York. Dear Mr. Rogers, I throw up the sponge. I pull down the flag. Let us begin on the debts. I cannot bear the wait any longer. It totally unfits me for work. I have lost 3 entire months now. In that time I have begun 20 magazine articles and books and flung every one of them aside in turn. The debts interfered every time, and took the spirit out of any work. And yet I have worked like a bond slave, and wasted no time and spared no effort, Rogers wrote, proposing a plan for beginning immediately upon the debts. Clemens replied enthusiastically, and during the next few weeks wrote every few days, expressing his delight in liquidation. Extracts from letters to H.H. Rogers, in New York. We all delighted with your plan. Only don't leave me out. Apparently that claim has been inherited by some women daughters, no doubt. We don't want to see them lose anything. B dashes an ass, and disgruntled, but I don't care for that. I am responsible for the money, and must do the best I can to pay it. I am writing hard, writing for the creditors. December 29. Land, we are glad to see those debts diminishing. For the first time in my life I am getting more pleasure out of paying money out than pulling it in. January 2. Since we have begun to pay off the debts I have abundant peace of mind again, no sense of burden. Work has become a pleasure again, it is not labor any longer. March 7. Mrs. Clemens has been reading the creditors' letters over and over again, and thanks you deeply for sending them, and says it is the only really happy day she has had since Susie died. XXXVII Letters, 1898, to Howells and Twitchell. Life in Vienna. Payment of the debts. Assassination of the Empress. The end of January saw the payment of the last of Mark Twain's debts. Once more he stood free before the world, a world that sounded his praises. The latter fact rather amused him. Honest men must be pretty scarce, he said, when they make so much fuss over even a defective specimen. When the end was in sight, Clemens wrote the news to Howells in a letter as full of sadness as of triumph. To W.D. Howells, in New York. Hotel Metropole, Vienna, January 22, 98. Dear Howells, look at those ghastly figures. I used to write at Hartford, 1871. There was no Susie then, there is no Susie now. And how much lies between one long lovely stretch of scented fields, and meadows, and shady woodlands, and suddenly Sahara. You speak of the glorious days of that old time, and they were. It is my quarrel that traps like that are set. Susie and Winnie given us, in miserable sport, and then taken away. About the last time I saw you, I described to you the culminating disaster in a book I was going to write and will yet, when the stroke is further away, a man's dead daughter brought to him, when he had been through all other possible misfortunes and I said it couldn't be done as it ought to be done except by a man who had lived it. It must be written with the blood out of a man's heart. I couldn't know, then, how soon I was to be made competent. I have thought of it many a time since. If you were here I think we could cry down each other's necks, as in your dream. For we are a pair of old derelicts drifting around, now, with some of our passengers gone, and the sunniness of the others in eclipse. I couldn't get along without work now. I bury myself in it up to the ears. Long hours, 8 and 9 on a stretch, sometimes. And all the days, Sundays included. It isn't all for print, by any means, for much of it fails to suit me. 50,000 words of it in the past year. It was because of the deadness which invaded me when Susie died. But I have made a change lately into dramatic work and I find it absorbingly entertaining. I don't know that I can write a play that will play. But no matter, I'll write half a dozen that won't, anyway. Dear me, I didn't know there was such fun in it. I'll write 20 that won't play. I get into immense spirits, as soon as my day is fairly started. Of course a good deal of this friskiness comes of my being in sight of land on the Webster and Company debts, I mean. Private. We've lived close to the bone, and saved every cent we could, and there's no undisputed claim, now, that we can't cash. I have marked this private, because it is for the friends who are attending to the matter for us in New York, to reveal it when they want to, and if they want to. There are only two claims which I dispute, and which I mean to look into personally, before I pay them. But they are small. Both together they amount to only $12,500. I hope you will never get the like of the load saddled onto you that was saddled onto me 3 years ago. And yet there is such a solid pleasure in paying the things, that I reckon maybe it is worthwhile to get into that kind of a hobble after all. Mrs. Clemens gets millions of delight out of it, and the children have never uttered one complaint about the scrimping from the beginning. We all send you and all of you our love. Mark. Howells wrote, colon, I wish you could understand how unshaken you are, you old tower, in every way. Your foundations are struck so deep that you will catch the sunshine of immortal years and bask in the same light as servants and Shakespeare. The Clemens apartments at the Metropole became a sort of social clearinghouse of the Viennese art and literary life, much more like an embassy than the home of a mere literary man. Celebrities in every walk of life, persons of social and official rank, writers for the press, assembled there on terms hardly possible in any other home in Vienna. Wherever Mark Twain appeared in public, he was a central figure. Now and then he read or spoke to aid some benefit, and these were great gatherings attended by members of the royal family. It was following one such event that the next letter was written. Private, to Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Hotel Metropole. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.